All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, a podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight is episode 196 of the show, and we're going to be talking about Knives Out. My name is Daniel Elwood. I am your co-host, and my co-host is an alt-right Nazi masturbator, Robert Johnson. Let's check in with you, Robert, see how things are going in the restaurant biz with mask mandates and how those are treating you these days.
Oh, it's lovely. It's quite lovely. Actually, business is picking back up, and haven't had a whole lot more complaints. Just a few dissatisfied customers because we've just been swarmed with so much business that we're having trouble meeting demand. It's kind of a catch 22. You want more business, but you don't want to disappoint people by not being able to meet that business. So we got to ramp up production, but we really can't do that without our own facilities. So it's, it's tough. We're in kind of a tough predicament, but it's nice to have a lot more customers that want your stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting because it seems like with the squashing of entrepreneurial activity and business, small business, especially by the local governors, that it would have had a opposite effect. But perhaps is it because of the squashing of all of competitors that because you're still out there, that's what's drawing people in? Or are people more of a mindset of, you know what, this has gone on long enough. Fuck this. We're going to go out and we're going to, you know, enjoy life, because what's a life unless you're out actually living, right?
Yeah, I think it's some of column A and some from column B. I think that there are some reduced choices, not entirely so, but there have been quite a few restaurants that have gone under, never to reopen. I think a few that have changed hands. I mean, Tom Wood says, just because a company goes out of business doesn't mean the stuff goes away. So those restaurants, I mean, of course, it's going to destroy the livelihood of those people, but that location and those restaurant, you know, materials can be picked up and used by somebody else. And that's a lot of what's happening. But yeah, there are some that have gone under and are operating at reduced capacity, and we're probably seeing some benefit of that. And then another is it's just people want to get back to normal. So I don't really know. I don't hand out questionnaires, but I have my own opinions.
Right. But the market is speaking with the increased sales, so you must be doing something right. And it's interesting you bring up that Tom Woods point. I've heard that point in other places as well. And I've always thought of it in the line of, well, those assets, the physical equipment is still available and somebody else will buy it probably at a discount because they're liquidating or whatever. But it also, and this has just dawned on me, it frees up the resources that that business would have otherwise consumed to be available for other businesses. So it's kind of like a twofold thing, like the original stuff that's pre-existing gets repurposed or reused, probably at a discounted rate. And then what they would have demanded future is now allocated and available for other productive capacity.
Indeed. Although we are still seeing the market is not being able to meet demand for takeout containers. Since the whole world's gone to takeout, that they're really struggling. I don't know if the manufacturing, you know, is still being done or at what capacity is being done, but I know that the increased demand from the whole restaurant world on takeout materials has got to be up, and it's just really hard. We're using these biodegradable sugar cane fiber takeout containers, which are fine if you are doing like sandwiches or anything cold or dry. But for hot, wet food, it has a tendency to just melt right through the bottom. So we have to end up like doubling up on those, and it eats into our costs. We really, as much as I'm not a huge fan of styrofoam, it is a much better takeout container in forms of holding food at temperature and then not leaking it out. So I would love to get some of those in, or some new material. If somebody could invent a material that is made out of biodegradable contents and is able to hold food like styrofoam does, man, we would be your first customers.
All right. You know, it's kind of funny because I heard about this in California as well. And then we should actually get into the show because we have a great guest. They had to reverse the ban on straws or something because because everything's now needing to be biodegradable and there's increased demand for it, there's not enough supply anymore. And then there's better materials that aren't allowed to be used. So they have to roll back some of those environmental regulations to allow these things to happen. Also, I heard that the masks that these disposable masks that are being used, they get thrown out and they're going to be like an environmental hazard as well. So all around, it seems like they back down on these draconian environmental measures because the things don't work, or it increases the cost, or it's just creating other problems downstream. So kind of ridiculous stuff.
Unforeseen consequences through central planning. I've never heard of it, such a thing.
I know. Who knew? Well, anyway, this has been a good discussion so far. I don't want to take too much more time because we're going to get in the last Knives Sports Show, talk about Knives Out with our guest right after these messages from the Last Knighters. So here we go. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Johnson, and we are the Last Knighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Knives Out. This is episode 139 of the show. You can find the show notes more at lastknighters.com/139. We have a great guest coming up for you in just a moment. But I will say, if I've learned anything from The Princess Bride, it's that they make good knives in Spain. And this episode was actually a suggestion by a listener from Spain who contacted me on Twitter a little while ago. And he said, "Hey, y'all, can you review Knives Out?" I said that we could in a few weeks, and here we are. And he said, "Awesome. Thank you very much. Love the show, by the way." So I just want to share that with you, Robert. Somebody actually listens and likes the show. So that's good news.
What?
I know. Incredible, right? Also, I wanted to mention that as a surname sharer with Ryan Johnson, Robert, I will hold you partially responsible for his ruining of the Star Wars franchise with The Last Jedi.
This is partially my fault?
Just because of the surname sharing. But yeah, pretty much.
Well, I'm used to lots of things being my fault, so understandable.
All right, fair enough. Well, let's introduce our guest. I've been wanting to have this guy on for quite a long time. He is the Meme Policeman. Hello, Meme Policeman. We can call you Ryan, I think you said. So Ryan, the Meme Policeman, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience and tell them what you do and where they can find what you work on.
Sure. Well, it's great to be here, guys. The Meme Policeman is basically just a fact-checking site that kind of specializes in social memes on social media. And so I'm sure you've all come across things on your feed probably on a daily basis. You know, you see memes, you're like, you know, that's not true, or you might think it's not true, or maybe you just aren't sure, is that true? So basically what I do is, you know, do the research, analyze it, and kind of do, you know, a brief breakdown using you know, credible sources, so you can kind of get to the truth. So I'm not quite as legendary maybe as Benoit Blanc of this movie, but you know, I try to bring some sort of sanity to social media, which fortunately is sort of lacking these days. But yeah, you can find the website's memepolicemen.com, and most of the action happens on the Facebook page, just Meme Policeman, and also on Twitter, at Policeman Meme. And then I do have some also in tutorial instruction videos on YouTube as well. So that's where you can find me, and happy to be here talking about this movie.
So if I may, before we get into things, I'm just curious how you go about policing memes. Just what kind of, you just go to Snopes.com and say whatever that is? Well,
Snopes would be sort of a competitor almost, that but no, what I do, so I kind of monitor certain pages. You know, I try to pick out memes that are, you know, pretty popular, that are you know, either a popular topic or a viral tweet or meme, and something that's being shared a lot. So, and then I go ahead and just mostly do my own research, you know, wherever that may lead. And then I try to find the most credible, you know, sources so that, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. I just kind of lay out, you know, what I found, and then you can go double check and agree with me or not agree with me, but try to get people closer to, you know, to the truth, which, because you know, obviously memes have no real fact checking behind them. It's not, I mean, as bad as the media is, you know, memes have even less, you know, less behind it. So,
with the, like, I'm just imagining one of your posts. I'm sorry, I've never seen one, but if you had a post, you got like a meme, and then then underneath it, you've got all the, your sources.
Most of the time I either label, put something over it saying misleading or false. Not always, because sometimes they're not exactly fit those categories. They just deserve, you know, commentary. But so if something is, and then so whatever the meme is, usually they make some sort of claim, you know, and then I will basically debunk that claim, sort of like a Snopes, I guess, but I kind of have my own style, and you know, break it down. Some things take longer, so I try to fit it on a Facebook post or a Twitter thread. But some things need more analysis and longer, and then I usually have a website post for those. But so generally I break it down into bullet points. So maybe like 5 to 10 bullet points would probably be average for most memes, as I, you know, kind of cover the main things you need to know.
Okay, so you don't necessarily the link, like, this is my source for this information.
Well, on the bottom, I'll link all the sources that I used. On the Twitter thread, I try to, each claim that I make, I'll link, just with the nature of Twitter, that it makes that easier. But on Facebook, I just put them all on the bottom, so you can find it. Usually there's only like, you know, 2, 3, 4 sources that I use. So.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for explaining to this old boomer.
Yeah, I feel like we should have both been up on this, Robert, before we had him on.
It's all right. I can ask questions about the internet, Daniel. It's all right.
But yeah, I started it about 5 years ago now, and you started small, but it's been steadily growing. I think we just passed 40,000 likes on Facebook. So a lot of the posts now are getting some good traction, which is nice. I'm not, you know, unfortunately, most of the memes that I cover have been shared, you know, hundreds of thousands of times. So it's kind of that thing where, you know, a lie gets around the world, and before the truth has a chance to get its pants on, or whatever the saying is. But
yeah, it's like the headline gets out there, and then they do the correction or the retraction on page 12, like a week later.
Yeah, or the Twitter version of that, they, you know, it gets, the first one gets 10,000 retweets, and then, oh, sorry, I messed that up, and that gets like 20 retweets. So, but that's the world we're living in, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's good stuff. I've seen them for a couple of years now, and that's why I've wanted to have you on for a while. And it seems like, and I swear we'll get to the movie, everyone, but it seems like you have a very fact-based and almost objectivist perspective that you bring to the analysis of the events. It's very much like, here was, you know, the action, here's why this, you know, is a misleading statement from the meme. So it's very much like a point by point takedown of these things. And I think it's really hard to argue with your analysis. I think it's pretty much spot on almost every time. I haven't had any real disagreement with anything I've seen.
Yeah. Well, I try to explain, you know, where I'm coming from. I do have a little bit of, you know, objectivist influence for sure, kind of often between objectivist, libertarian sort of circles, but I try not to let that influence necessarily the post, which would be about finding the truth versus for that situation. But, you know, every fact checker is going to have their perspective. So I feel like I kind of have a unique, you know, thought process versus like a Snopes or a, you know, some of the others out there. Not that those, you know, I think people should listen to those as well, and just compare with maybe what I'm saying and, you know, what others are saying. And, you know, that's the best way to get to the truth. You know, have the best argument, the best facts win. That's kind of my philosophy.
So what would you say your ratio is for finding memes to be false or true? Is it mostly false? You find ones where you're like, that can't be true, or I want to see if that's actually true or not. And then you go out and you find evidence to debunk it, or mostly confirming memes?
Well, most of them you can't really debunk because most of them are just stupid and they have an opinion, or, you know, they're not much you can do with. So generally they have to make some sort of claim, factual claim, particularly numbers. And I'd say probably the majority of them are misleading. So they take like a piece of the truth and omit, you know, all the context and, you know, to mislead the viewers. So what I do is I bring in additional context and say why that's misleading. But so a lot of them I do from like Occupy Democrats, which is, and the other 98%, which are probably two of the biggest left-wing pages. I find it's harder to find right-wing memes on, like, there's not as many meme pages that post widely shared memes that are debunkable. A lot of the right-wing memes I find are, you know, troll type memes, or they're just, you know, they're sillier. They're just making an opinion. So, you know, as I say, the left can't meme, but they also have a lot of misleading and false memes. So a lot of the left memes to make more specific claims, basically. So that makes it easier to debunk. So
I see. So yeah, I would say, I don't pay attention to a lot of left-wing memes. But I do notice that a lot of right wing memes are more like based around their beliefs and philosophy. Would you say that's kind of true?
Yeah, or they're like troll type meme, you know, particularly where the libertarian, maybe alt right memes are more like trolling, and it's hard to even take them seriously sometimes. It's like, are they trying to just provoke or mess? You know, but most of the left wing memes are serious, you know, they're not.
Yeah, they're serious. They're not funny at all. No. I'm in the memes for the funny. That's what I care about. I mean, sure, if there's some truth there too, that's great, and that makes it funnier. But I'm mostly there for the funny, and I don't want to necessarily look at a meme and get lectured to or explained this listicle about why their worldview is correct or something.
Especially if every point is wrong on it.
And then, at the end of the year, I do kind of a fun thing called the Meme Awards. So. Because normally I don't address the funny memes, and that's just not my thing. But at the end of the year, I try to give awards for all different categories, you know, like the funniest meme of the year, or the most annoying meme, or and then the best and worst. You know, I come up with a bunch of different categories to try to reward some of the good ones as well. But most of the time I'm dealing with the bad ones. So.
All right. So you're saying the Occupy Democrats is probably the worst offender in the meme world at this point?
Well, as far as you're concerned, they're probably the biggest page. I think they have like over 10 million followers. It's pretty crazy. And other 98% is also up to, I think they're above 6 or 7 million followers now. So, and the thing about those pages, though, they're just kind of like a bellwether. They're bellwether sites. They just kind of pick up what's in the zeitgeist and the culture. Okay. So, but I like to say they don't come up with any ideas on their own. Basically everything, all their memes come from usually either public statements from somebody or tweets or headlines or something, but they're just repackaging what's in the culture. So that's why I use them. So if Occupy Democrats post something, it's usually because it's been from a viral tweet or, you know, all over the culture somewhere. So.
What percentage of left wing tweets are funny?
Tweets or memes?
I mean memes. Sorry.
Every once in a while, if you had to put a number, I'd probably say like 10%. You know,
that's not that that's
too maybe 5%.
Okay, that's more.
Every once in a while, I have to give them credit, but most of the time, it's they're not good.
So we've answered the question that the left can meme just about only 5% of the time. Are they successful?
Left can rarely meme.
A revised statement. All right. Well, thank you for the exposition on what you do there. And people should check it out, memepoliceman.com. And we do appreciate you joining us for this episode. And we usually start off with the Google description. So once I read this, then we'll go to Robert for his opening information. So if you guys are ready, make it on screen. All right. Here we go. Knives Out came out in looks like 2019. It was an American mystery film written and directed by Ryan Johnson and produced by Johnson and Pam Ram Bergman, a modern day whodunit. The film follows a master detective investigating the patriarch's death after the family gathering gone awry. It came out 2019, just last year, 7.9 on IMDb, 97% Rotten Tomatoes, 82% Metacritic, and 93% of Google users liked it. The description is, the circumstances surrounding the death of crime novelist Harlan Thrombley are mysterious, but there's one thing that renowned detective Benoit Blanc knows for sure. Everyone in the wildly dysfunctional Thrombley family is a suspect. Now Blanc must sift through a web of lies and red herrings to uncover the truth. Director and screenplay Ryan Johnson, box office $309 million, and got a few nominations from the Academy Awards. And Robert, we'll go to you for your open.
Well, I've seen this movie twice now. Once for pleasure and once for the podcast. And I enjoyed it much more when I was watching it for pleasure. Not to say that it wasn't enjoyable the second time around, but I already knew the story. So it was, you know, you don't get to go on. I think the most fun for me in this film was in the reveal at the end with Blanc kind of laying out what actually happened. And then you get to put all the pieces together and see if it all fits in your own mind. That's the real joy in this kind of a film. So it was more fun the first time around. Obviously the second time, you know what's going to happen. But I really did enjoy this film. The acting is all fantastic. All the performances are a lot of fun. I really also enjoyed the storytelling strategy here. Like the way that the story was told. Like I thought it was going to play out much more like a Clue type of movie. I mean, it's obviously based on it. Plays fun with its influences, Clue being one of them. But the movie sets up some kind of red herrings at the beginning, kind of introduces the idea that some of these other family members could be involved, but then it quickly forgets about that. Like just when they're doing their initial interviews and they're showing some flashbacks of the other members of the family, we find out that it could maybe be one of them. But then we get zero more information to kind of like, ooh, maybe it could be this person. Ooh, maybe it could be that person. We just kind of follow along on Marta's story. And we find out that, well, at least it wasn't her. But we're not exactly sure what is happening until the end. Man, I was along for the whole ride. I thought probably my favorite standout performance was Chris Evans. He was just having so much fun in that film. But so was James Bond. He was doing great, even with his funny accent that he did. I think it was just a whole bunch of, you know, character actors really hamming it up and just having a good old fun time and a good old fashioned whodunit. And I'm not going to give it a perfect score, but I really don't know if it's a whole lot of flaws to it. And it surprised me that this was a Ryan Johnson film. Not that he's not a talented guy and doesn't know how to tell a story, but just between this and Last Jedi. And I was like, you know, these two things don't match. I mean, I thought that Last Jedi was pretty atrocious. And then this was quite well done. And I think he also isn't this also the guy who did Looper or something like that? Or maybe it's something else I think of.
I think you're right.
Yeah. So the guy can tell a story. He knows what he's doing. He's a competent filmmaker. And I had a lot of fun with this one. But, you know, they can't all be winners, I guess.
Yeah. Now, Robert, did you find that like in The Last Jedi, where there seemed to be a lot of messaging underlying almost every scene, that there was something similar in this? Because a lot of reviewers that I read seemed to think that there was a lot of kind of politicizing or messaging in this.
I remember when I first watched it, because I watched it on Amazon, and then I scrolled down to the reviews, and it was either 5-star or 4-star review or 1-star review. And there was no in between. There were no like 2s and 3s. It was just either, this is a great movie, I had a lot of fun, or this is SJW trash. And I honestly didn't see a whole lot of it. It wasn't like in Last Jedi, where Kathleen Kennedy seems to want to smash and ham-fist. Like, she found an ally in Ryan Johnson, where he was like, yeah, Force is female, we're going to cram all kinds of feminist stuff into this movie. Whereas I think when Ryan Johnson's just working on his own, doing his own thing, I just don't really see it. Yeah, there is the social justice character, and there's the alt-right Nazi troll, supposedly, quotation marks, kid. And they kind of have it out a little bit back and forth, and at one point the kid gets called a Nazi. But it was all done kind of I mean, it wasn't like they were throwing ideology in your face. It wasn't like there's this super strong female character and she's going to do everything the best and she's the awesomest and everybody loves her. And I mean, there is a really sweet main character who kind of gets by because she's so nice and cares about people and that sort of thing. It wouldn't play into the evil machinations, but it wasn't just because she's just the best all the time and whatever. I didn't see it like it was in The Last Jedi. I saw it more as a hammy, fun, quirky character type thing. I thought it was kind of, it just added some little bit of flavor to the mix that there would be an SJW kid getting an SJW degree in college and then getting her college paid for by grandpa and then the mom double dipping. And, you know, and then I thought that was all fairly even handed. I mean, just the fact you can't, are these reviews saying that you can't even have these characters in your movie? I think it reflects kind of a society.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot to that. And I actually liked how they treated them because they almost treated them in jest and just as like character enhancement. It wasn't like, oh, the SJW person is like this great person. No, they were kind of poking fun at her a little bit. And then they were also poking fun at the alt-right troll kid, calling him a Nazi, but not like seriously and not in the way that people call you that on social media these days where they actually mean it. But this was more of like, oh yeah, he's, you know, he's just there to like upset people or whatever. But yeah, Ryan, you want to pop in?
Yeah. I mean, the alt-right kid was more of a, just like a small character. I thought like almost like comic relief at times, you know, like your kid's a Nazi. Like it was almost like a joke. Whereas, you know, it did have that element, but you know, the social justice warrior daughter was almost more evil in a way. You know, she starts out kind of like pretending to care about, you know, the immigrant nurse and, you know, but when push comes to shove and they're not going to get their inheritance, you know, then all of a sudden they're, you know, they show their true colors. And that's, you know, whereas like, I mean, the alt-right kid does at one point, I think, say, call her an anchor baby or something like that. But but beyond that, like he kind of played a small role. So there was a little element of that, but I thought it was, it wasn't like they were treating the social justice warriors as good and the outright guy as bad. It was like a funny family. Like everybody in the family is bad, basically. I mean, everybody in the whole movie is bad besides the nurse and I guess Benoit Blanc and the father that died. But the whole family is evil in their own ways, and some are on the right and some are on the left. And so I didn't find that made it overtly, you know, political.
There was, I agree. If you're making a movie in 2019 and you're going to have some political characters talking about politics, I mean, at one point, who was it? Don Johnson? What's his name? Is that his real name? Don Johnson. Yeah, he gets into an argument with everybody. Yeah, Miami Vice, he gets into an argument with people about, I guess, what, immigrants and other, like, follow the law kind of thing. So that scene seemed a little bit on the nose about somebody trying to inject politics, just a little bit. But who hasn't been to a family gathering where the talk isn't about politics? I can't visit my relatives anywhere where there isn't somebody talking about politics. So I thought that was perfectly believable.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the one guy, I think it was the Michael Shannon character, Walter, he started singing Hamilton.
Waltz. Yeah.
He's talking about how so good and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, in general though, if just my overall take on the film, I really liked it. It was probably one of my favorite films that I saw last year. Just in the fact that everything's so crazy now. This movie just allows you to have 2 hours, just be totally immersed in this, you know, whodunit story, which is, you know, a genre that not really that used anymore. Like, but it kind of brings you back, you know, if you read like Agatha Christie novels, you know, when you're younger or things like that, it just like engaged your mind the whole time. You're just trying to figure out things. And then, you know, at the end, it's, you know, the good triumphs over evil and reason triumphs over, you know, everything and the truth. And, you know, I kind of like that theme. It was just an enjoyable film, well acted. It's not like a super important artistic film that's, you know, going to stand the test of time, but for, you know, it's a great movie for what it is, 2 hours of enjoyment. So
yeah, I tend to agree with that. Absolutely. Now, one issue I did have in the very beginning, I think I told Daniel right away when I watched it, and I said, hey, this is a good movie. I had a lot of fun, but
big but.
I had a little issue with just how super genius Daniel Craig was. And I wondered if either of you guys felt the same way. Like when he was breaking it down and laying out exactly what had happened, I was like, did you just perfectly read everybody in the situation and put all the evidence and facts into your head and supercomputer spit it out like a bat machine computer? Just be like, this is the guy that did it, and this is exactly how he did it, and all that kind of thing. It was fun, and I enjoyed his breakdown and that kind of thing, much like Tim Curry's in the original Clue movie. That was a lot of fun too. But when I first saw it, I was like, there's no way he's that smart and he figured that all out. But the second time I saw it, I didn't have that same impression because I'd already seen it and I knew he was going to do it. So I don't have that ability to really judge, you know, whether or not it was unrealistic or not. I wonder if either of you had that same feeling, or is it just me?
Daniel? Yeah, I had a similar feeling, but I think I can pin it down a little bit. I don't think it's that Daniel Craig Bond was so good at figuring out. I think that it's just so incredibly unbelievable what actually happened, that Ransom left. And then as he's driving away, he decides, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to come up with this elaborate switcheroo plan, break in and do all this stuff, all in the matter of moments. I don't find that to be a believable turn of events. If he didn't have this thought out well ahead of time, I don't think that this is a sudden within moments process.
Right. He has an argument with the grandpa. And then as he's driving away, he stops early in the driveway and then turns in and then sets up the whole chain of events. Like it all came to him in like 1 month. Like it, obviously he said he was honest when he said, you know, he figured out he would have to fend for himself. And his mind immediately goes to wicked, super complicated revenge murder scheme. Okay.
Right. And it depends on Marta being responsible for the death, even if she didn't actively intend it with malice, so that this Slayer rule thing plays into it. Like he has to have all this foreknowledge and information about this, but he's this spoiled brat, like playboy guy. I just don't see it happening. So that was the part that made it unbelievable for me. Ryan, what was your take?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's definitely some holes in it. I would call it plausible, but definitely you have to suspend a little bit of belief for some of the things. But the other is, you know, when Marta thinks that she's killed him with injecting the, you know, the, like she gives him like 100 milligrams of morphine or something. Yeah. Like, wouldn't you like realize? I mean, it's not going to take 10 minutes to, I mean.
Yeah, wouldn't you feel some effects?
I don't normally inject morphine, but from what I imagine, when you inject something, you're like, you know, pretty messed up right away, especially if it would be that much. You know, it might take 10 minutes to die, but he seemed pretty lucid and able to construct this whole.
Like, wouldn't it like numb your whole body? Wouldn't you just be like, okay,
I don't know,
feel this. Do you feel this?
Yeah, but Saving Private Ryan, when they're giving him morphine.
Yeah, they inject this little morphine. Yeah.
Yeah, but and it's like almost immediate. Yeah, but it's almost immediate for the pain relief. Yeah. So like, well, you feel it almost suddenly.
Yeah, when they inject heroin, it's, you know, that it's like right away from what I imagine.
Yeah. So that was another thing that felt totally unbelievable to me, that he would be aware if he had received morphine, and especially that quantity. You know, he was supposed to have, 3 milligrams to help him relax, and he must have, like, been familiar with the feeling, right? And obviously he wasn't feeling that, unless it's like a placebo effect because he believed that's what it was. But I just don't see it.
Yeah, you'd think you'd feel a lot different. But not only that, to have the mental capacity to think through, like, this elaborate scheme that he has her do, you know, while you're on that much morphine, I would think would be difficult.
They did set that up with saying that the plots of his novels just came to him.
Oh, okay.
Real quick. Yeah. So that, you know, he's already got these stories in his mind. He's got to think right. out how characters act and that kind of thing. So
it's plausible.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with Ransom. Maybe that's the genetic thing that he could just, he had this plot preconceived in his head, not that he was actually going to use it on his grandpa, but it was there and just came to him. And so that's why he turned around. I don't know. Maybe that explains it away a little bit, but
Ransom could, beat him at that whatever game they were playing, so could Marta. So that I don't know exactly what that meant in the movie, but if it meant he was had the same sort of brain or, you know, but that was sort of an interesting thing of that, that game that they played and that they were the only ones that beat him. So.
Yeah, I don't know why Marta, it was important that Marta could beat him at Go other than to have the conversation point come up in the argument. Because obviously she wasn't a schemer. She never planned anything out in the film, you know?
Yeah, I kept waiting for a turn to be, oh, Marta actually is bad. Because they play her up as so good.
Yeah.
You know, and even Bond is like, oh, you're such a good person. And I don't believe that, you know, this stuff. And she actually thought she was the one who had done it by mistake, of course. And she started hiding evidence as a result. So she's not exactly... I mean, that's a bit ambiguous, right? Like, she knows she didn't intend to do it, but she's also like, well, I don't want to get caught.
Right. Well, she's also like the mainstream media, where she will be factual, but not entirely truthful. I mean, she will say partial truths to avoid vomiting. So that's fun.
I thought the vomiting thing was another thing that wasn't exactly believable, but it was kind of an interesting thing in the story, I thought. But is that even, has anybody ever...
I don't know if that's a real thing. I don't know.
I think Rian Johnson just had to build on in these mechanics to make the plot kind of work, because like he had to have her be able to beat the grandpa at Go and Ransom be able to beat the grandpa at Go so that the Nazi masturbator would overhear Ransom having the argument. And then the subject of Marta came up, and that would be the tell to Bond to know that Marta came up in the middle of that fight for some reason, because there's no other reason other than they're arguing about the will. Well, therefore, he must have been talking about Marta and the will at the same conversation.
Yeah, I wonder. I imagine when you're writing one of these kind of stories, it really is you're putting pieces of a puzzle together and you are just coming up with things that are semi-plausible to fit, because this must be kind of difficult. I imagine he worked on the screenplay for quite some time, because there really aren't a whole ton of holes other than I think the morphine one and then the quick thinking murder plots. But and then also, I'm glad you guys didn't have an issue with Blanc's big reveal of knowing everything. It bothered me a bit at the beginning when I first saw it, but I think it's such a fun, it's the big payoff for the film is the big reveal of what actually happened and does it all fit and make sense. And were you along for the ride, and is a big satisfying conclusion? And I think it's a very, very satisfying conclusion. I thought it was all that fun. And then even to have, one of the cops be a big fan of the novelist guy. That was a fun inclusion where he was pointing out little key details. Oh, these are from that story. That's from that. Oh, this is totally like this story. That was a lot of fun. So I had a great time with this movie.
Yeah. Now, Robert, in your second watching of it, and Ryan, I think you watched it a second time as well recently. Did you guys find that there were breadcrumbs and clues in the film that would reveal what actually happened? Or is it not that you can actually see these things, and so then you're dependent on Blanc coming up with this out of nowhere reveal? Because that kind of is unsatisfying to me. There was a critique of Sherlock, the BBC series, that goes into that kind of concept where, you know, Matlock and shows from the 80s that you would watch, and for 45 minutes you're like, how are they going to get out of this one? But sometimes you go, oh, that's the dirty character, that's the person who did it, and then when you find out that's who it was, because you were observant throughout the show, that you could figure it out before the main character, before the Columbo moment, right? But I'll go to Robert first. Did you find that in the second watching that there were these clues where you could have that Columbo moment? Or are you relying on Blanc coming up with this without the information available to you?
Yeah, I think you're reliant on Blanc. Now, to be fair, though, my viewing of the film did change drastically. Not drastically, but there, especially with certain scenes, like where I'm paying the second time around, I paid key attention to Ransom and his mannerisms and the way he was acting. And I interpreted them wildly differently the second time. The first time when he shows up, I think it's where he's like at the will reading. And he's sitting down.
That was a fun scene.
He's having a great time. He's like, fuck you and fuck you and screw you and I hate you. And this is, he's just having a blast. I interpreted that very differently the first time. I thought of that as the guy that is sick to death of his blue blood family and he's just wanting to see everything burn down because he thinks they're all hypocrites and, you know, this and that. But the second time around, I saw it very differently, and how he was super excited to, you know, watch the will reading and knowing what was going to take place, that Marta was going to get all the money, and still kind of sticking it to his family, but from a period, from a position of foreknowledge. So those are two very different readings. And he's still my favorite character in the film. I still think, he did a great job acting wise, but you're right. I don't think that there's a ton of breadcrumbs for the audience to pick up on otherwise, other than his performance. And even then, in the first time, I interpreted a completely different way. Now, maybe that's because I wasn't perfectly analyzing each individual character, but yeah. You know, each character had a motive for the most part.
And I like your idea that was brought up, and maybe it should have been followed a little bit further so that you actually, by the end, you still think it could have been any of them. I think that would have made a better film.
Yeah. I guess he didn't fit into his puzzle piece movie, but it really would have been nice to have some red herrings for some of the other characters along the way, other than just in that initial interview.
Yeah, and Ryan, I want to ask you the same question after one follow-up to Robert. And is that, in your second viewing where Ransom is at the will reading, was it your understanding that he had conceived of his plot to split the money with Marta and so thus screw the rest of his family, and that's why he was so flippant with them? Or was that conceived of later after they escape and go to that diner and he feeds her soup and makes her puke and whatever?
Yeah, no, I think... I interpreted it. I don't know. Maybe I'm right or wrong. I don't know. But I interpreted it as he was excited to get all the money or half of the money and then have a backup. I mean, he was going to be good either way.
Okay. That's I don't understand how he would get all the money.
No, not all. Either half or his share, his normal share.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so Ryan, your take.
Well, at first, at the will reading, he would have been thinking that, trying to deconstruct this, but that Marta would, like, he had already framed Marta in his mind, right? But he didn't realize until he sat down with her in the cafe that she had actually not poisoned him, right? So that's what he realizes in the cafe, because prior to that, he thinks that he's framing Marta. That's why he hires Benoit Blanc in the first place, is to get Marta. It's not until she starts telling him the story that he realizes that she didn't give him the vials that he had set up or whatever. So it's at that point that he has to switch his thing to only get half the money or actually he's before that, he was just going to get his own share because she would be found guilty and that would void the will. And he would have just gotten his own share with the rest of the family. But at that point he realizes he can get half the, or does he still only get his share? I can't remember.
He would have gotten his share, right? But I think he was mostly happy and excited for the will reading because he was just...
Well, at that point,
he had his popcorn in his hand, and he was just happy to see his family lose their shit. Exactly. I think that's what he was mostly happy about that.
And he knows that he's going to frame her, you know, so he's going to get it eventually, and he's just, sitting back for the ride.
I would say Schadenfreude full on, and he's just being like, fuck you guys, you're not getting shit.
For me, the nice thing about the first time through the movie is that you actually midway through start to think that Ransom is actually could be the good guy, you know, cause he's almost too obvious at first. You're like, there's no way he's super pissed off. He's the black sheep of the family. There's no way he's the one responsible. That just seems too obvious. And then he's like, oh, maybe he's going to be, you know, the hero. And then he's helping Martyr. And then, then he obviously turns at the end, but the second time through, obviously you don't have that, that kind of journey, and you're just, you said, you're watching him more carefully. The other thing I noticed more the second time is that, Marta had that, the blood stain on her shoe, which was kind of given early on in the movie. And that's why Benoit Blanc knew from the beginning that she had something to do with the murder, but he also knew that she couldn't tell a lie. So, but that was kind of one of the interesting things I didn't really notice the first time through, but the second time I'm like, oh yeah, there's that blood stain on her shoe that he saw.
Yeah, with. I noticed that early in the film. I only watched it the first time, and then Blanc noticed it as well. And what was the point? I don't understand, because there was no, like, it was obviously a suicide because there was no blood splatter or shadowing or whatever would have happened in any area of the room. Like, there was a 360 degree like blood pattern, but she was so far away. How would she have gotten blood on her shoe anyway? Like, she peeked in through the door and was like, ah, this happened. And then she had to, you know, leave.
Yeah. My thought was that when he slit his wrist, it would fly and she just got that one little speck.
He severed his carotid. So That's going to shoot out.
Really, right. But didn't really she not notice until she opened the door and saw him? And wouldn't that have been after the fact?
No, she saw him slit his wrist, I'm pretty sure.
I thought she saw him and then she turned away, right?
Or not his wrist, his throat.
Throat, wrist.
I don't know. I'd have to watch it again. All I know is that it made sense to me at the time.
Okay. All right. Maybe I'm well, weird. So we've done a few nitpicks. I have one more. And I don't know if this is a real thing or not, yeah. But it seemed to me, if you're going to have medications, that you wouldn't want them to be in the exact same vial, same colors, same everything, except the words might be slightly different. Now, the reveal told us that Marta is so experienced that she could actually, without even knowing, sort of like when you're sexing chicks, they can just, you know, you hold up the chick, and if you're good at it, you can 99 times out of 100 pick male, female. You guys aware of how they sex chicks?
Oh, yeah. I'm almost guessing this.
I'll post a video about it, but it's apparently like there's nothing visual. There's no visual thing. Like you just get good at it. You practice it enough and then you somehow intuit this. So she got almost intuitively, she did the right medication. But when you looked at them side by side, it just bothered me that they were so identical looking other than one, you know, one word on them. That just seemed unbelievable to me. I don't know if that's how.
Oh, you mean before when they're in their actual bottles, why would they not look differently?
Yeah. Well, yeah, like why would you want morphine to look identical to this?
You tell me, Janet. You believe in the market, right? Come on now.
Well, it's probably highly regulated. You know what it probably is? It's probably a regulation that says the label must look identical.
The vial must be this dimension. But I don't know. I'm not.
I don't know.
Well, it bothered me. But okay. It might be a regulation thing. I don't know. But Robert, you got any notes? You want to take us down?
No, I took zero notes. And I was looking. Honestly, I was really, really looking. But I was just in watching it. And I just had a lot of fun. I don't know. I wrote down, I think I wrote like one note saying that so-and-so just called the other one a Nazi and a social justice warrior or something. And that was it. I think you guys are coming up with some great points. I think just this discussion of the plot and the characters and the story has just been a lot of fun. So I don't really have any like key takeaways. It's more of a, this is just a pure entertainment film. I don't necessarily say this is like a political statement or an important film that people need to see. It's just something, if you want to have 2 hours of good time, I can see why murder mystery novels are, or at least used to be, a really, really popular form of entertainment. Because they are engaging. And it's fun to see a film like this, you know, in 2019. I would love to see more like it. Or I don't know if this genre is going to get, you know, refreshed or reborn. But if people can start making kind of more films similar to this, I think it'd be a lot of fun. I'd watch them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why it feels so refreshing is that it kind of embraces facts and reason, and, you know, cause we're living in this era where, you know, postmodernism, like there's no such thing as truth, or truth doesn't exist. All this kind of, you know, nonsense philosophy, which shows up in all sorts of films as well, where things don't make sense. Like, you know, the whole, you know, it's not emphasizing the efficacy of reason, let's say, you know, and being highlighted and being admirable. So that's what this movie was about, you know, the truth, getting to the truth with the facts. And I think that makes it appealing, and it's logical. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's not a lot of films like that anymore. You know, like the most famous film last year would be Joker, and Joker's just like, it was a great film, but it's just, you know, a depressing film, a film of that highlights human misery, mental illness, you know, like the guy, like he doesn't have a choice. He's just destined to become, you know, this Joker because he was abused in the past. And, you know, it's just, it's a very down, depressing film, but, and now of course it feels like we're living in Joker essentially, you know, with the riots on the street. But so, yeah, that's why I enjoyed it so much. And again, it's not like super important film, you know, from an artistic or statement. It's just refreshing and well done. So,
yeah. Based on what you just said, I do have to mention that it was refreshing to see the character of Benoit Blanc as a just very highly competent, intelligent man that knew what he was doing, could analyze people and their motives and the evidence at hand. And he's just very much it's just evidence of the power of the human mind and its ability to process information and to deliver justice. I thought that was a really, really cool thing.
Yeah, he seemed philosophically grounded, and he had a lot of great quotes about truth and finding truth, and that truth is an objective thing that will reveal itself, which I liked that, because there's so much talk, especially in social media and censoring and what is truth and fact checking and all these things, like right in line with what you do, Ryan, at Meme Policeman. But, you know, who is the arbiter of truth? Who decides what's true? And especially when things are, you know, nuanced or taking, you know, needing philosophical foundation with which to view things to be able to derive what truth is. And yet they just like, I'm trying to come up with the right word, but it's like they had this hubris on these fact-checking sites, especially on Facebook or whatever, to remove posts or try to correct things that they really don't know. And they can't actually know. They just have a very biased opinion that happens to disagree with whatever the opinion was or whatever the facts might have been for some event that somebody posted. And then people see that it got fact-checked or they see something got removed, and then they can't make the decision for their own, for themselves. And I think that's a dangerous precedent, and I really don't like it. JP Sears just got shut down from YouTube, I think, as a result of some of his parodies. And, you know, you can't... It really feels like you can't speak your mind or have opinions or have a competition of ideas anymore. It seems like it's more just, it's the MSM mainstream opinion or else, and that's it.
Yeah. And so what I do every once in a while, I should probably do it more often, but every once in a while I'll do a post saying just in that vein that I'm not the arbiter of truth. So when I plaster false over a meme, that doesn't mean that I'm like sent from heaven saying that it's for sure false. What it means is that from all the available evidence I've looked at, which I lay out, and the sources, I've determined that this is false, you know, and that's all I can do. So I try to have people treat fact checking sort of like science. So, you know, science, it would be irresponsible for scientists to say this is the truth. What science is, it's like, from all the available evidence, we found this to be true. But if something, we find something later, then, you know, we'll update our findings. But, you know, to claim like for a fact checker to claim that they are the arbiter of truth is the wrong. It's wrong epistemologically. You know, that's not how the truth works. So the truth is what are the facts of reality, and then it's, we use our reason to obtain that, and there's, you know, limitations, and but if you follow the process, you get, you know, you can arrive at the truth, but with the caveat that all of our knowledge is contextual. So there's no such thing as sometimes you'll hear people say like, what is absolute truth, or you don't know that for sure or 100% sure, and that's confusing what human knowledge is, which is always contextual, right? You can't, we're not God. We're not a, you know, infinite being. All we know is a certain context, and that's what knowledge is, you know? So from everything we know, this is what we know. And, you know, if I find something else out, then I'll update my context, but that's all we can do.
Well said. That's absolutely right.
The irony.
Based all on right. all evidence, based on all the evidence I have, I believe that to be true of me.
But you do right. see that a lot of people make that mistake, though. You know, especially with the science, you know, things that, well, scientists say this. It's like, that's not what science is. I mean, yeah, you should listen to experts because they have generally a better understanding and context of a certain thing. But to say, like, if a scientist says something, that means it's the truth, or, you know, that's just not how science works or knowledge right. works. So
it's not how, yeah. Truth is not arrived by consensus.
No. Right. And how many times has the consensus been wrong? There've been things in, I think they're called scientific revolution turning points. I'm sort of butchering it, but there's been consensuses held by the majority of thinkers in a certain area, all believing, you know, the earth is flat or whatever, and then all believing that the earth is the center of the universe, and then all believing, you know, certain things. And then there would be some abstract out there idea that would be ridiculed and mocked for a long time. Well, first ignored. And, you know, it's like the Gandhi quote, like, first they ignore you, then they make fun of you, then they fight you, then you win. And then everyone flips over to this new kind of perspective, and that becomes the new consensus. But it's like this ever evolving thing. I think Rothbard had a thing about it. I'll try to find it, post it on the show notes page. But yeah, it's basically, you know, the concept of, you don't actually know. You're always seeking and searching, and like, the scientific process is about testing theories and repeatable experimentation and things like that. And even that has issues that Hans Hermann Hoppe has talked about in the Popperites. Like, if all knowledge comes from scientific experimentation, then what of the truth of that statement of itself? You know, who says that that's where all information comes from and all that? So it's really interesting, kind of a philosophical take on this. And I kind of like Benoit's perspective and his grounding of, you know, finding truth and even having like some great quotes about what truth is and how it can reveal itself. So I like that part about
the inevitability of what the rainbow, truth's rainbow, or what was it? What was that line he said?
Oh, I'll have to look it up, but it was eloquent.
the arc of truth's rainbow, and he goes towards the arc and he sits and waits for it.
Oh, didn't he say that he didn't know what it meant, but he thought it sounded cool? It was like a book title or something?
Yeah, it was a book title. Yeah. He didn't read it. He didn't read the book.
Yeah, that's a great commentary too.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's great commentary on just in social media, people just read the headlines and then form their opinions.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. Anyway. So Ryan, sorry, I cut you off like
it's okay. I was saying, have any of you seen the Civil War documentary from PBS? Like, that was back in like the '90s.
Like Ken Burns?
I think I've seen the Ken Burns of it. I haven't seen it all. I saw the whole Vietnam, but I didn't see the Civil War.
Well, I'm bringing up the Civil War because Benoit Blanc just totally reminds me of the same speech pattern as one of the guys in there that, like, one of the main historian guys in the Civil War. But if you've seen it, you'd remember.
Like, I liked it when
Louisiana accent.
Leghorn.
Yeah, it's like he stole it right from that from the Civil War guy.
It's good stuff.
All right. Well, any last points anyone wants to bring up before we get into final summary and review, where we give it a score? It can be, you know, sometimes it's out of 10, sometimes it's stars, sometimes it's black and gold, sometimes it can be whatever. We could, you know, give it a number of knives, whatever you guys want.
I will just say that the very ending, well, how it ended was I thought very clever. When after the whole reveal, you know, he's busted, but then he's going to kill Marta with the knife, right? And then of course it was the prop knife.
Movie prop knife, yeah.
I thought that was just a really interesting end. You know, it was just kind of...
Did he get unlucky and grab the prop knife, or were they all...
Were they all... I don't know.
I can't imagine all of these are prop knives. It doesn't look like...
There got to be some real ones in there.
Yeah. Now, was this telegraphed early on? Was somebody like messing with prop knife early in the film? So then
I don't remember any prop knives early in the film.
I thought it would be, but I didn't notice it when I watched it the last time. Cause that seems like something that should have been maybe foreshadowed, unless that would be too obvious. Maybe if they did that, I don't know, but it was a fun end. I thought.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Robert, why don't you take us down Final Summary Review Lane?
Well, good on you, Ryan Johnson. This is a complete passion project. I don't know, passion project, but it's completely all him. He wrote the story. He directed it. It's all him. You can't blame anybody else for this thing. And you can't praise. I mean, I'm sure you could praise everybody. You can praise all the other people involved, of course, but it seems to be his brainchild. He must have loved the movie Clue and whodunits like I do. I can still watch Clue to this day. It's so much fun. And I think he's made a great tribute to that film with Knives Out. He's kind of reminding me a little bit of a Tarantino, not necessarily in his directing style, or maybe not even at his like talent level. Maybe he's just slightly under that. But he is, I mean, other than The Last Jedi, I mean, throw out Last Jedi. And he's got Looper, which is like his take on sci-fi, you know, time travel. And then he's got a whodunit mystery movie. I mean, you don't know what he's going to do next. This is great. This is some kind of a creative talent that you don't know what you're going to get from him. So I'm, as long as he stays clear of Disney and their social justice feminist crap, and he doesn't try and, you know, inject it. And I think he's probably just excited to work for Disney. And he's like, yeah, Kathleen Kennedy, I'm a total feminist too. I mean, maybe he is, I don't know, but it really seemed he played up to those expectations in The Last Jedi, especially, I mean, you're getting called on and to make a second film in a trilogy. It just, it seemed like an awkward situation for him to be in. So he probably felt like, you know, he didn't have as much control as he normally would have liked in a movie. That's just my guess. I don't know. I don't know the situation. I know there are all kinds of like social media things where he's like wearing a t-shirt that says Force is female and rah, rah, rah. I mean, you're at Disney. You're making a Star Wars film. You probably dreamed of making a Star Wars film when you were a kid or being in a Star Wars film. So you probably would have gone along with whatever just to be doing it. I'm sure he was just really excited. And then the massive backlash afterward kind of, you know, crashes that whole feeling, and probably never wants to go back and do it again. I know they wanted to, what, give him his own trilogy? Or was that JJ? I forget. No, I think it was Ryan. Anyway, I like him better when he's doing his own stuff. He seems to be a fun filmmaker that I loved Looper. I mean, we could dissect that and talk about how this and that didn't make sense, but I thought it was a great, engaging story. He's a really fun, engaging storyteller, and you have to suspend some disbelief. It's true, like with all films, but I am willing to do that for this guy. Throw out Last Jedi. I thought it was not good, and I'm sure there are a whole bunch of Rian Johnson hate due to that movie. I think that's a little bit unwarranted. Not that he doesn't deserve some scorn, whatever, you didn't like a movie he made, but I think you gotta respect the guy for making stuff like this. This is a lot of fun, brought together by some really fun talent that he just let them cornball it up and just have a great time. And everybody looked like they were having a good time. And it was a great ride. So I originally, when I saw it, I think I gave it an 8, just solid fun, 8 out of 10. I think I texted to Daniel. But I'm going to bump it up just a little bit more. I think this is like an 8.5, because it was just, I want to see more stuff like this. When I go to a movie theater, I want to just have fun and be engaged and just lose myself in that world for a couple of hours. And this is that. This is, what else could you want? I don't know. This is a lot of fun.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you for that, Robert. And I'll jump into mine and then we can go to you, Ryan. I also thought this was a fun film and it was well executed. I did find that the holes or the plot conveniences were a bit much to be too believable. So I kind of had issues with that. And I also see a huge missed opportunity in that I like the idea of there being the opportunity or the ability for a viewer to have figured it out along with Blanc rather than Blanc having just super abilities. So, you know, it's more of a game if you can be the one to, if you're clever enough and perceptive enough to see the clues throughout a film and then know the answer before they reveal it. I think that that adds another dimension to it. And I think that this would have had just that much more panache to it if they had done that. But other than that, it's, you know, it's well acted. It's well directed. It was really great to see a lot of these familiar stars. And man, a lot of them are looking so much older. Jamie Lee Curtis looking really old in this one. And another thing that stood out to me, and maybe this is just the whole lockdown thing, but it just felt weird seeing people out in the world and in close quarters together in a recent film that almost, you know, seems like it could have been, you know, just it felt so much longer ago, even though it was so recent. I don't know if either of you guys experienced that as well, but it just felt like to me, like that type of interaction is of the past now. And that's kind of a sad thing.
Yeah, no, it felt like this was how people behaved pre-lockdown.
It's like at airlines, being able to meet people at the gate as they're coming off the plane. Like that used to be a thing like 20 years ago or 25 years ago. And now it's totally gone. And probably a whole generation of people have no idea what the hell I'm talking about. I think as far as the score goes, I got to go with Daniel Craig inspired 007 on this one.
007 knives out of 10, huh?
007 knives out of 10. I know that's cheesy as hell. But Brian, let's get your final summary and review. Your score, please.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the lockdown because I first watched this in the lockdown. I think it was in April or something like that. So it's one of the reasons why I liked it so much is, locked in my house and it was good entertainment for a night. But before we talked about it here, I probably would have given it an 8.5. But as we kind of hashed out some of the holes, which you guys showed, I probably lowered a little bit, maybe 8.0. But overall, I just like that they made a film like this is what I'm happy about. But it's not like it's not like an important film in any regard, you know, as far as the story. It's just like a for fun film. So I'm not sure you can give it much more than 8.5. I enjoyed it. And I agree that I hope there's more like it. It's if we had movies like this as a standard for an entertaining movie, that would show a healthy culture. Instead we have Joker and Parasite last year that, you know, I don't think necessarily shows a good culture. So 8.0, that's a review.
All right. Well, very good. And I'm unfortunately, this is a common theme here on the show is that we tend to ruin movies for people. So after they listen to us, they see certain perspectives that they didn't notice the first time. And so it actually does knock it down a peg or two. Robert's actually known in some circles with people I talk to about the show, like, oh, Robert, the co-host who hates every movie. Well, not every movie. All right. He gave it a really good score.
See?
This one.
See? I like stuff. Some stuff. I like good stuff.
Yeah. It's got to be a pretty high bar for Robert to like it. And speaking of a high bar, if people like us, if we are a high bar, check it out on Patreon, lastnightish.com/Patreon. You can support what we do here. You can see the pre-show and post-show content that we do before and after the show. The post-show is called King Turner Overdrive, and I hope Brian will stick around for a little bit longer than that thing you can do a little bit. But it's been a really good conversation so far, and I really appreciate you coming on for our show. And if you could remind everyone where they can find what you do, and then we'll get into some King Turner Overdrive right after this.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's been awesome to be here. MeanPoliceman.com is the website. But again, most of the action, just follow me on Facebook at Mean Policeman and Twitter at Policeman Meme are the two places that I do most of the content. Also check out, there are some videos I've done on YouTube. They're mostly tutorial type things. So my intention is to explain to people how they can find information on their own. So I have one on like finding hate crime data. There's unemployment data, things like that. So they're kind of brief tutorials, and it just shows you how you can access this, find and interpret the data on your own. So you don't need to rely on the media or even me. So.
All right. Very good. Well, and Ryan, I'll probably want to talk with you about this a little bit in the post show, the King Turner Overdrive. I actually have a post on my fan page or my Facebook fan page that is a bunch of articles, mainstream articles that debunk a lot of common arguments from the left. So rather than finding stuff that they're just going to say, oh, that's from the Daily Wire or that's from Fox News, so I'm going to just, you know, say it's no good. This is actually from like HuffPost or from USA Today or from, you know, so they can't kill the messenger and that maybe the message will actually get through. And that might be something that might be useful for some of the stuff that you do. To find sources that are palatable to them, because they often point to the source being the problem rather than listening to the argument.
Oh, yeah.
So I think
whenever possible, I try to use either mainstream sources or just government or you know, like government statistics sites, or if it's a study, go right to the study. I try never to use the, you know, right wing, I guess, type sources, just because I know that'll be an objection. You know, if you're trying to, you know, argue a point to somebody on the left and you use like a Breitbart article, be like, well, that's just Breitbart. So yeah, I try to avoid those, and go straight to the direct source, you know, if it's available.
All right. Very good. Well, everyone do check out memepoliceman.com. He does great work over there. And Ryan, you've been a great guest. Hopefully you can stick around a little bit longer. And Robert, next week, we're going to be getting into some gangster shit, talking about some gangsters and some gangster shit. Godfather 2 with our man Keith Knight from Don't Tread on Anyone.
That's just my normal life every day, baby.
So we're skipping Godfather 1, apparently. We're going to go straight to Godfather 2. Though I think I'm going to have to maybe try to watch both and refer to them, or maybe we'll do Godfather at some point in the future. So we'll figure it out. But anyway, let's get into some Kathleen Overdrive. So welcome, or thanks for being a guest, and thanks for being a listener. Find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/139, and I'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and we'll continue the transmission for just a few more moments on the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is episode 196 of the show. And Ryan, thanks again for sticking around as long as you have. Robert has stepped away for just a moment, so I might have to repeat this back to so he hears it. But I wanted to get your take on one of the reviews for this movie, Knives Out, that I thought was a little bit more of a pointed question. And this is, like you were mentioning, from a organization or a periodical, a source that might have certain leanings, but it's National Review, and they saw this as a politically charged take on immigration. So the review states that the movie revels in the alleged moral superiority of the oppressed and dares its audience to object. And the writer was Graham Hillard, and he says, the question of who will possess a house becomes a metaphor for who will possess a nation. He says that of the ending, that anyone who doubts that Knives Out is and means to be a commentary on the future of race dynamics in this country need only examine the movie's intensely political concluding shot, in which Harlan's family is cast from the manse and left to dwell in the outer darkness. That is quite an interesting take, and I think they're seeing quite a lot in something that might not be there. I mean, I can kind of see where they can suss that out, but I don't know if it's intentionally there.
Yeah, I think I did see some of those reviews that, you know, it was like a triumph of the immigrant over rich people or over Trump, even depending on how you want to interpret it. But yeah, I mean, I could see that, but overall, I think it was that was minor, and that's not what the central point of the story was. It was she was a good person because she was a good person, not because she was necessarily an immigrant. You know, that didn't really have anything to do with her being a good person. And, you know, the rich people being bad didn't have to do with that they were rich necessarily. It was that, you know, they just were bad, and being bigoted was part of that, you know. But their father was, you know, a good guy. And of course, Benoit Blanc is white and he's good. So I think that's maybe reaching a little far into it. It wasn't the essence of the story, in my opinion, and it could easily be ignored. So it wasn't shoved in your face, you know, like some other movies might.
Right. And actually I think that her being an immigrant was actually one of the mechanics that made the plot be able to work, because there was a reason that even if she had accidentally given Harlan the wrong medicine, they couldn't call the ambulance, because then she would be discovered, or her mom would be discovered as an illegal immigrant. And so that's why Harlan said, no, don't call the ambulance. Yeah. Let's figure this out, you and me, right here. You know,
there was that element of the, you know, her family being undocumented, which in a gave like a sympathetic appeal to that, you know, for sure. So that is probably the most, you know, overt political message in there, is that, you know, she was a good person and she was afraid because her mom was, you know, undocumented illegal immigrant and should, and, you know, could get in trouble. But again, that was like I felt like that was a minor aspect, you know, of the story. Although it was kind of funny that most of the family wasn't like, they kept confusing where she had come from. Like, I'm not even sure it was exactly clear what country she came from. Cause like, you know, some of the family thought she came from like Brazil or Uruguay or wherever it was. So, but that was more of like a comedic, you know, underlying element, I think, and not, I wouldn't read too much more into that, honestly. But
yeah, I think four or so different of the family all said at different countries, like Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay, Brazil, or whatever. But yeah, I think that Ryan had to have that as a plot point or mechanic to make the story work, because that was the reason why Harlan didn't want her to call the ambulance, because that she would be found out. And then also that allowed Walt to use that as a threat in the hallway to try to get her to renounce the inheritance, because he was like, well, I'll call the INS. I'm going to weaponize this government arm to get you to do what I want you to do. So I think that kind of had to be there for that to work as well. It would have had to be a different threat if this
was
wasn't
part of the plot. Yeah. And but it was interesting how, you know, the liberal, the left part of the family was just as evil and basically bigoted as the right. It's just almost the right wing ones were almost more honest about it, you know, up front, whereas the left ones, you know, pretended to, you know, be all about immigrants. At several points, they're like, we consider you part of the family. We're going to do everything to help. And then when it came down to it, they revealed their true side and, you know, called her the, you know, bigoted names once it came down to it. So I thought it was almost knocking the left more than the right, you know, in this movie. So that's why it didn't really, I think it wasn't really an overt political statement.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. And yeah, you actually mentioned that earlier on when the girl, the SJW girl who had said, oh, you're so important to us, you're part of the family. But then she was the one who turned on her and called and said that she was alone and just trying to talk to her to find out what she wanted to do. And it turned out the whole family was there. So, you know, she was even lying there.
That was a really good scene, because that was when, because before that, you're almost like, oh, they're portraying this. She was sort of like a good character up until that point, and then you realize she was like a backstabber, basically, you know. And he definitely seemed like he was taking a shot at kind of the SJ social justice warrior types in this movie. Like, they were not, he was not sympathetic to them at all. So
I think he gave equal treatment.
And the alt-right guy was shown as kind of a little weaselly loser dude, but he only had like maybe one line in the whole thing, and you know, he was kind of like in the background, so it was almost more for her as just a caricature and comic relief, you know.
All right, Robert's back. So we're still winding down the actual anarchy portion of the show. I had wanted to get your take on the question, but maybe we'll do that in the KTO. So that's going to be our episode, everyone. So meanpolicemen.com, check it out to see Ryan's work. It's really good stuff. This has been our episode on Knives Out. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/196. There are other ways you can support the show. You can hit us up on YouTube and give us a subscribe while we're still there. We're not kicked off just yet. I'm really surprised, Robert, we didn't get kicked off after doing conspiracy last week, talking about Nazis and the Von C conference, where they talked about the final solution. I figured just those words would have gotten algorithmically triggering some kind of censorship or something, but yeah, it worked out. So anyway, we'll see you guys all next week for Godfather Part 2 with the great Keith Knight. And we'll say maximum freedom to everyone. Peace out.
The Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.